Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. Right now, an immense joy is Michael Feroli, Chief U.S. Economist at J.P. Morgan. And the hallmark of his weekly notes, written Friday evening, it comes out about 7 p.m., is you talk about going beneath headline analysis, and that's the J.P. Morgan team, even algebraic functions. Michael, algebraic functions, Friday night at 8 p.m. is a highlight of my Friday evening.
I'm sorry.
What do your algebraic functions say about the American housing market? Units are grim. Price hasn't moved.
So housing clearly is suffering a little bit from higher mortgage rates. And we saw that, again, with the new home sales that Mike just mentioned, as well as almost every housing point we got last week. And we would expect that to continue for the next several months, just given the lags between when mortgage rates go up and when home sales come down. That said, we're coming off, you know, white hot levels. And so we're basically, I think, getting a little bit back more into balance. And it's likely to be the case that inventories, with housing home sales coming off, inventories will likely remain pretty lean. And home prices, we don't see home prices declining, certainly. So hopefully getting a little bit more into balance, cooling off, but not a not 2006 by any means.
Michael, this question pains me to ask, but are people getting too gloomy as they start to price in some sort of slowdown that allows the Fed to be patient?
So the Fed, I think, will continue moving after, obviously, we're going to get the June, July 50 basis point moves. And I think to the point you discussed earlier, look, Chair Powell is an outcome-based guy, and he wants to actually see inflation and activity slow down. So while housing may be a leading indicator for the economy, I think Powell will actually want to see things slow before he actually pulls off the rate hike. So I do think that maybe we've gone a little bit maybe we're thinking the Fed's going to be too gentle here with the economy, but they really have their work cut out for them, and so I don't see them pausing after July.
What are you looking for, Michael, as a sign that truly we are seeing some sort of slowdown with respect to inflation at a time when we're hearing from everyone here that the consumer is still very strong?
Yeah. I think you'd really want to see the labor market soften more materially than we have seen. Again, we don't want to see a lot of unemployment, but the jobless claims numbers that we just mentioned, those can suggest we're still in a, you know, very hot labor market. So you would like to see next week not only job growth slow, but, you know, perhaps vacancies come down. And we'd like to see that happen, you know, in a smooth kind of linear fashion. Generally, it's not the case, but that would be the ideal scenario.
Yeah.
Where you have a nice slowing in job growth.
One of the key sentences I've heard here, Michael Feroli, is central banks that really don't have reaction functions right now. They're making it up as they go. As you and Bruce Kasman and your team piece together tomorrow's note, do you have a mathematical structure or a geometric structure of where we're heading? Or are you as blind as the central bank?
Look, I think it's clear that the Fed is not operating and has not been operating by anything close to a Taylor rule or any other type of formulaic reaction function. So I think that makes, you know, gauging central banks here a little bit tricky, but that's been the case for a couple of years where, you know, you can do your implied Taylor rule and it doesn't look anything like what the Fed's been doing. So that's just a fact we're living with.
What is the fact we're living with? As Lisa mentions, to just watch the consumer? Is that the heart of the matter?
So the consumer matters. I think the consumer will follow where the labor market goes. And that's why I really emphasize the labor market. And, you know, we can talk all about excess saving and all that, but it's really labor income that's driving consumer spending here.
Yeah, Michael, that's Jamie Dimon on line 3. Pick up the phone. Say hi to Mr. Dimon for us. Michael Feroli at J.P. Morgan. Jeffrey Yu is just brilliant with BNY Mellon. And Jeff Yu, you say they're wrong. All the people doubting Plaza Cord and dollar intervention are wrong. You mentioned the giant Frankel of Harvard, and you say we need to start to think about a Plaza Accord of 2023. Why is the dollar too strong?
Well, the dollar's too strong in terms of valuations, but the US needs to figure this out on its own accord. The dollar itself from the Fed is not really going to matter, you know, in terms of financial conditions. You look at the four pillars of financial conditions: rates, exchange rates, spreads, equity markets. FX, by a long way, ranks last. And also, what does Japan need? What does Europe need? Europe, finally, they're changing their tone. You know, they need a stronger euro to bring down inflation, right, but they need to realize this actually strengthens consumer sentiment as well and their purchasing power. So this is a very different environment compared to several decades ago. We need to think about not a new plaza or louvre or anything like that, but what each country needs for themselves. So that's the difference between now and three decades ago.
Let's find common ground between David Folkerts Landau over at a small German bank and Ian Bremmer out with his new book, The Power Crisis and Every Nation for Itself. Jeff, you, how do you have coordination if you're not camped out in the lobby of the plaza in New York?
Well, you know, right now you have enough communication, you know, between the central bankers, and we've had that over the last 15 years or so, like the swap lines, you know, during the crisis, you know, during the pandemic. But it's kind of backward looking. There's coordination when it comes to firefighting, responding to crises. You know, look at how the sanctions were brought in after the war started. But, you know, where is the coordination up ahead in an era of deglobalization? That's the philosophical question we need to ask. If you're talking about deglobalization, then why bother coordinate? Isn't deglobalization by definition every central bank for itself? So philosophically, where do they stand right now? Where do governments stand? There needs to be harmonization. If not, then we can forget about picking up the phone.
Okay, so Jeffrey, if we don't get that harmonization and we stay where we are, which is in maybe perhaps not a deglobalization, but a regionalization of partnerships, how do you see the euro reacting at a time when people are downgrading some of their growth expectations for world growth? And we're starting to see, I don't know, the euro get a little bit of a bounce from that.
So I think Eurozone policymakers, and to their credit, the ECB is starting to realize this. A strong currency need not be a bad thing. You know, there are more things to an economy than a trade surplus. Let's get away from this 17th, 18th century mercantilist way of thinking. I know it's harder for Asia and Euro to dislodge, but if you have stronger purchasing power, that could actually help offset, you know, some of the inflation losses to real income, you know, as well. So they need to state a stronger euro at this point, and the euro is still going to be under valued, like even five big figures from here, right? So that is good for the Eurozone households. It can lift their demand. In real terms, that's good for the euro. So they need to actually cross that hill. They're not there yet, but finally they are starting to shift. So I think the euro will find a new range, a higher range, but still, even with a higher range right now, it's still going to be very, very much undervalued.
We're talking about fluctuations that are minuscule, at least for this week. But the big elephant in the room at Davos has really been China, Jeffrey, and how we deal with the fact that the slowdown that we're seeing from shutdowns probably are not going to end anytime soon. How do you map that out into a currency call, into a growth call, at a time when it seems as though that is going to remain the policy, at least for the remainder of the year?
Well, what's fascinating is if we look at our iFlow custody data, our clients are starting to buy CNY, they're starting to buy Chinese equities, and after an unbroken run of, let's say, three or four quarters of selling, gentle buying in Chinese government bonds as well. So it looks like the global markets, they're so underweight China right now, they're not actually taking a growth view. I highly doubt that because of the lockdown still happening. But maybe they're just starting to find some value on a total return basis with Chinese equities, Chinese bonds, and also the currency, you know, where it is. But to translate that from a re-rating, you know, from a growth view, I want to go overweight China again, the window is narrowing, I'm afraid. So we need more stimulus, more government-driven stimulus and demand lift right now. But yesterday's Premier Li's comments, he said basically, you know, to local governments, you need to fend for yourselves, well, you know, right now. They're very limited resources. That's tough.
Dr. Yu, let's turn to your virology expertise, which is, if China ends on lockdown, what happens to the greater Pacific Rim? One day it's going to be over, then what?
Right, then we are going to have, not only in an Asian, but probably a global context, the mother of all services stimuluses. And we're talking about not just lockdowns ending, but also borders reopening in China. There's no time frame for that. But look at how Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, the ASEAN countries dependent are on Chinese tourists. Davos, you know, Tom, go to the watch shops in Davos, you know, are they complaining about lack of Chinese tourists and they're buying all those Patek Philippe's, right? So when they return, that $200 billion services deficit China runs with the rest of the world, that is going to be such a big stimulus, something we can all look forward to. But right now, again, no timeline.
Do you think, Jeff, that we're seeing right now, people bake in an appropriate slowdown when we take a look at the global economy, or do you think that there's more to come to be priced into risk assets and, frankly, even to yields?
So on a qualitative basis, I think we need to differentiate what is a slowdown versus, so basically soft versus hard landing. I think people are still baking in a soft landing right now. But if the Fed turns restrictive and we still think the market's actually not appreciating the risk of that enough, we're talking Fed funds rate, you know, going to 3.5 to 4, that kind of level, then a hard landing, that I think the market is probably taking a bit too lightly right now. So we're not saying it's over yet by any stretch. The markets are appreciating a growth slowdown. They're just not ready to bake in a harder landing. So I think that's where some further pricing is needed. But in the short term, valuations adjustments, weighting readjustments, you know, we're seeing a bit of a risk bounce. But I think the Fed will have the final word on that.
Jeff, you're brilliant. Extremely important note, really pushing against the forget about the Plaza Accord consensus. Mr. Yu with BNY Mellon today. We get to rip up the script to do that with Amrita Sen, chief oil analyst at Energy Aspects, truly excellent on the microeconomics of what Brent crude will do. Amrita, in your academic studies, do windfall profit taxes work?
No, and especially not at a time when you're asking oil producers to also raise production, right? Because there is a bit of a supply crunch. So no, the answer is no.
I go back, Amrita, to Lyndon Baines Johnson and the idea of an investment tax credit. Now, Sunak is going to fold in here. If you invest, you don't pay as much tax. What kind of investment program spurs oil production?
The problem right now is that, you know, we do need investment for sure. And in to your question, what kind of investment spurs oil production? You're talking about investment in the North Sea. And that is not overnight. You are going to still look for, or you need to first and foremost find the oil. But again, you can, I mean, there are small fields that can still be extracted and you can get some tieback projects, which are pretty quick. So say within a year, you could get oil out. But these are small volumes you're talking about, maybe 40, 50,000 barrels per day rather than hundreds of thousands of barrels per day, which is what we'll need. If anything, we probably need in the millions of barrels per day. For that, you need a sustained investment program. And, you know, particularly the UK North Sea is a declining asset. Norway, on the other hand, actually has much better prospects. So it's not that lucrative to necessarily invest. But having said that, there are still assets which oil majors over here could extract oil from. And if the tax incentive is right, I think the world needs that oil and they would be more than keen to develop that. Except, of course, that there are ESG pressures on them as well. So that is always going to be the tension, whether shareholders necessarily want them to invest in oil and gas, regardless of the tax structure.
Amrita, how much is this an issue of getting the oil out of the ground? And how much is this an issue of refining it so that people can use it to power their cars and their homes?
Well, it's a great question because we've got shortages in both right now. Of course, we're not investing enough in the upstream. That's been a trend for the last 8 years. In fact, on our database, we've not invested much more than $400 billion each year for the last pretty much 8 years. And since last year, China changed its policy around refining and product exports, and we've closed about 3 million barrels per day of refineries in the West, mostly in the West. So we are very short of refining capacity. We have a few refineries starting up in the next couple of years and even back half of this year, but not nearly enough to meet demand. So we are constrained on both sides, but right here, right now, I'd say we are more constrained on refineries. So the oil you and I would consume, that's more constrained than actually the crude oil side of things, which in itself is a challenge with OPEC spare capacity low.
Amrita, all of this comes together in a toxic brew, if you will, that only raises costs for consumers and continues to do so despite wobbles in the actual crude market. How much, I understand that perhaps that we're not going to see oil companies produce more as a result of the tax that's being proposed in the United Kingdom. However, how much does it just give cash to be able to offset the costs for people who are going to only see those costs climb?
The challenge is going to be, how are you going to make this a global solution, right? Because oil markets are global. And I think part of the problem politicians in the West have is that they're always trying to come up with local solutions. Even the US is talking about potentially limiting diesel exports. That's just not going to work, because ultimately both crude and products markets are very, very global. So we have to acknowledge that oil and gas demand continue to grow very, very sharply, particularly in Asia. And even, you know, right now, China is not even growing. So imagine when China does come out of its zero COVID policy, the impact it's going to have. And we need to therefore facilitate enough investment across the board, not just in oil and gas, but also in renewables to meet that energy demand. Otherwise, like you say, there is only going to be one thing, that the cost goes up. It is pretty right. simple, demand and supply.
I'm reading an unfair question, and this goes back to 1980. And the experience of the United States in a, quote, windfall profit tax, which many people would suggest was just a flat-on excise tax over the already elevated taxes mm-hmm. they were already paying because they were making more money. And Rita Sen, if the United States affects a British equivalent in a windfall profits tax, what does that do to a gallon of gas?
Well, I'll say this much. I think at least producers we speak to in the US have said the administration has considered it and probably still is. You will see US shale production fall because, again, what's the incentive? Much like in the UK, what's the incentive in the US to continue producing if you're just going to be taxed? And if that happens, then crude prices go up even further.
Yeah.
Refining was already constrained. So, you know, gasoline prices are already high. And of course, it's going to make matters worse. But the crude price will definitely rise.
Amrita, 20 seconds. Where is gas prices? Where are they going to go in the United States through the remainder of this year?
We think it's going to continue to go higher. You've got Memorial Day driving season and it's starting up. And yes, inflation is high, but this is the first time in a couple of years where there are no restrictions and people are going to be driving and flying as well. So both gasoline and jet fuel prices will continue to rise.
And Rita Sen, thank you so much for joining us with Energy Aspects. Our last section in Davos, and of course, as we know, we can't afford anything in Davos to buy or rent. We might as well talk to Jonathan Miller or eat. Jonathan Miller joins us, president and CEO of Miller Samuel, to tell us when housing is going to crack in America. John Miller, you would suggest we're starting to see an ebb. Is that because people can't afford the rent? They can't afford the mortgages?
Yeah, I think we're approaching a peak. I think rising mortgage rates are probably one of the best things that is happening to housing. In many ways, low mortgage rates are making housing less affordable because it has obliterated supply, whether in the rental market or the purchase market. We're seeing, I cover about 40 different housing markets across the US, and the market share of bidding wars right now is anywhere from 25 to 75% of all closed sales activity. That is not a sustainable condition. We need more inventory.
Tell us about the mortgage rate right now. Are the people that did short-term mortgages at lower rates, are they already in trouble given that we now have higher and higher rates?
So it clearly places more pressure on them given how much prices have gone up over the last year. We're looking at, you know, depending on the metric, around 20%. This next year, meaning 2022, more like 9 to 10%, and probably 3 to 4% the following year, even with the rate hikes. So all this is because there is limited supply. There's a firm underpinning. You know, this isn't a financial engineering exercise that we had during the bubble. Credit conditions are still tighter than, you know, historic norms. And and actually that's really driving, pushing some people into the rental market, which is making it even less affordable.
Jonathan, how much is this a story of private investors and investment firms buying up a lot of the single family homes and removing a lot of supply?
I think that certainly it's a factor, you know, and it becomes more apparent when you're already in a situation right now where inventory is about a third, is one third of what it should be for a normal, stable market. But I also think it's overhyped as a contributing factor. I think the bottom line is that rates have been too low for too long. And you know, you have to think of inventory as this living, breathing organism that takes time to recover, and it hasn't had a chance. And that's causing price growth that's just, you know, the likes that we've never seen.
And Jonathan, this is the distinction as people talk about 5%+ mortgage rates and the idea that the actual number of sales is slowing. The prices still are going up. When do we see prices peak, Jonathan, and how high do mortgage rates have to go?
So I think that pricing isn't going to I think it's more about the rate of growth that we're seeing. You know, we've been seeing in the last year a rocket ship, basically straight up. I think we're going to see a moderation. Look, affordability has fallen by half since the end of the year. Mortgage rates are up 2%. I mean, that's a rapid, sudden change, and that's going to slow down transactions. What's interesting is before the rate growth, sales were already falling, but it was because inventory had collapsed and was restraining sales activity. Now it's a combination of both.
Jonathan Miller, too short a visit. Thank you so much for joining this morning with Miller Samuel.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.